for the sermon, Mr. Randy Stanger.
It's always a good day when you get to wear your boots. I got up this morning and I wanted to wear this suit, and then I realized, you know, the slacks are a little longer than I like them for the heel on my regular dress shoes, so I thought, I'm going to wear my boots with it. And they last longer because they don't drag when you've got your Western boots on. So it's a good day when I get to wear boots. We grew up doing that. I had to start wearing cowboy boots, as we called them, when I was about 4. And then I never was without a pair for the rest of the time. And we had snakes. Actually, when I was 8, I got away with tennis shoes in Nebraska. We didn't have any poisonous snakes on the Oregon Trail down there. But in South Dakota, we had rattlesnakes everywhere. So we were not allowed to wear tennis shoes except right around the house and in the gravel parking yard where we, you know, put all our vehicles. And when they weren't parked there, that's where we played baseball and basketball and things like that on the gravel. We got to be good at dribbling basketball because it's hard to dribble a ball on gravel. You got to read the rocks. Even, you know, you don't just dribble without thinking. You're looking where the ball is going to hit because, you know, it hits that rock, it's going to jump over here. So a hand has to be there ready for it. So it was the challenges of growing up. But we wore boots all the time. When we weren't in the yard, you had boots on. And we killed about 20 snakes a year. And we only killed the ones that were wherever we found them because we had to go back there again, and we didn't really want them hanging around. We didn't go look for them specifically on purpose, but wherever they showed up on our pathways, you know, where we went through the fields or did our irrigating and things, we had to watch out for them. We irrigated with siphon tubes. I don't know if you've ever seen that done. We had we would cut a ditch down the end of a cornfield. And we ditched the rows. You don't have to do that here. You know, God irrigates your corn for you in this part of the world. But out there, we had only maximum of 14 inches a year. This year's the total exception. They've had 20-some inches already. Totally unusual. The wettest year we've had in 50 or 60 years. But we would portable canvas dams in the ditch, which would then fill it up, the section we needed, and we would set these tubes that would siphon that water out down the rows of the corn. And we might make a set of 100 rows. So you're picking up irrigation tubes anywhere from the 1 inches, which were easy, up to the 2 inches, which you'd stack them on your arm, and then you take them down to the next set, and you're throwing them down one in every place. My uncle was going along one morning. It was kind of a cool morning for summertime, and he was picking the tubes up and slapping them onto the stack. And he stopped. He reached for one, and then he stopped. And he looked. For some reason, he didn't grab it and decided he would look on the other side of it. And there was a rattlesnake. It had gotten cold in the morning, but the night had been, you know, extremely warm. So the snake, being a reptile, was trying to cool down. So it had stretched out lengthwise alongside this tube. And he would have grabbed the snake in his hand had he picked up that tube. Needless to say, after that, because I was just getting to the age where my brother and I had to do that all the time. We were looking on the other side of all the irrigation tubes from then on. Yeah, it keeps you alert. This is a good thing. Well, today I want to talk about, not about rattlesnakes and irrigation tubes, but about another subject that's very important to us, and we're here doing it. We're keeping the Sabbath holy. And this is a basic sermon. I'm trying to incorporate an additional number of these as we go through the coming months, covering basic topics so that we understand clearly how to apply the scriptures on every aspect of God's way of life that we live. So how do you keep the Sabbath holy? How do we keep the Sabbath holy? Because this has to do not just with us personally, but with us together at the service. And we'll look at two aspects. First of all, the before and after church services aspect of the Sabbath, how we keep the Sabbath holy. And then we'll look at some of the ways that are important for keeping the Sabbath holy when we're together at church services and fellowshipping and so on. But it is obviously a time of commemorating God's holy day. So let's start with the basic commandment in Exodus chapter 20. Go to the Ten Commandments there. And it's verses 8 through 11 of Exodus 20. The Sabbath commandment is the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, holy means that we don't sort of keep it because we think it's cool. We keep it because God made it holy. We'll look at when he made it holy in a moment. But here's the way that it is to be kept holy. 6 days you will labor and do all your work. So we have 6 days out of the 7 day week to do our work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God, and in it you shall do no work. You nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who's within your gates, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore God blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Hallowed means to make holy. By his presence, God made it holy. Did God need to rest? I mean, physically, we need to physically rest. And actually, they're coming to find that humans are built onto a 7-year biocycle, and we need downtime every seventh day. And there have been researchers who, you know, have not thinking about it and not necessarily searching for that at all, found that that's in fact the case. Others try to ignore it. But there are many who recognize the principle of the Sabbath. They don't recognize the Sabbath religiously, but they understand the principle of it. And they're wise people for, you know, what they know. We know about it ahead of time. Sometimes we underestimate the phenomenal insight that we have simply from understanding God's word and God's law. We have wisdom that goes so far beyond people in society who don't know these things. It is a treasure to have this knowledge. So God didn't technically need to rest. He wasn't tired. You know, God is, you know, life inherent. He's got all the energy of the universe. Well, no, he's got a lot more than that because he made the universe. And we know how much energy is. No, we don't know how much energy is in the universe. We know how much energy is in an atom. You know, because we blow some of them up. Either in warfare, World War II, you know, 70 years ago this past month, in Japan, with Little Boy and Fat Man, the names for the two bombs. And we saw the devastation they caused. And then they made bigger nuclear bombs, the hydrogen bombs. And they blew up islands in the Pacific. The U.S. did, France did, Britain did, Russia did. Russia blew up some of their own territory because they weren't always careful with their processes. So we know how much energy is in a single atom after a fact, you know, after a fashion. But how much energy is in the universe? God made all that energy and made all those things. And so God didn't need to rest. I mean, as far as needing to rest like we need to rest, but he did. He placed his presence on the seventh day, made it holy. So we can't make it holy. Yeah, so that's a misnomer of traditional Christianity. They think that they can pick a day and they can make it holy by resting it on it themselves or worshiping God. They don't normally rest in the way we rest. They think they can make things holy by their presence. Wrong. Only God can make things holy by his presence. And that's what he did with this day. And it's a wonder, and it's a marvelous thing. But obviously, it is a time when we don't do work. We do work the rest of the week, and we don't have our servants do work. Most of us don't have servants. We don't have our oxen do work. When it talks about your cattle, it's actually primarily means there those draft animals that have to work by plowing and pulling heavy loads and that sort of thing. They get a rest, too, and they need it. So it is the principle of resting and reflecting, therefore, on God. So with this commandment clearly in mind, then we can draw some conclusions. to study God's Word and reflect upon God, His Word, and His way. Study His Word and reflect upon Him and His way. That's something that we do to keep the Sabbath holy. It's a time, you know, we think, well, yeah, well, I try to do that every day. Well, that's good. But the Sabbath is a time when you can do some serious thinking. You're not just doing fleeting thinking in betwixt and between and when you're driving here or when you're mixing that up for dinner or what have you, but the serious reflection. It's not a time for us to be watching sports and entertainment on television or listen to it on the radio. And nobody listens to the radio entertainment anymore these days. All they have is sports on the radio. That's a sad thing. Radio used to be a useful item. It's become less and less interesting, and it's a sad thing that's happened. But whatever the case, this is not a day for us to pursue our pleasures and entertainments. And you think that that's not work. No, but it's not focusing on God either. That's the key. It provides us with extra prayer time where we can spend a little added time in prayer and thinking about things. Luke 21:36. Let's turn to Luke 21:36. Here's another principle of the Sabbath. That is applicable, a principle that's applicable on the Sabbath. Luke 21 is a chapter that is parallel with Matthew 24 and Mark 13. This is a prophecy that Jesus gave, a set message he gave from the Mount of Olives. Therefore, it's sometimes called the Olivet prophecy, referring to the Mount of Olives. But in verse 36, chapter 21 and verse 36. Watch therefore, he's getting near the end of the message. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things which will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. I think probably in every age of God's church since the apostles, the brethren thought they were at the end of the age. And you think, well, why didn't they look at the prophecies? We can see by the prophecies they weren't. Yeah, well, they couldn't. They didn't see that. They saw the impact of end-time prophecies, just like it transfixes us. And so they thought they were living at the end. In fact, they weren't. The apostles thought. James, Peter, John, they all thought they were at the end of the age, and Christ would return before they died. And then they realized the only possibility is he might return before John dies, because the rest of them are going to die violent deaths of martyrdom. After John 21, when Christ was telling them that. In fact, the apostles mostly all did. John didn't. But they had to come to know before the end of their lives, Peter and Paul in particular write about that in 2 Timothy and 2 Peter, probably the two books. And they're not very long books, so they're a good read on Sabbath afternoon. Just to see that they were beginning to realize that they were going to die before Christ returned. They weren't at the end of the age. But I believe very likely that brethren from that time forward, during their periods of calling, their time of being called to the truth, thought they did. They were. We think we live at the end of the age, and with good reason. More good reasons than any of them had, that they couldn't even imagine, you know, nuclear weapons or all the other things that the world has right now. So watch and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things which will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So when you look at the principle of watching on the Sabbath, if you watch the news, you're watching the news to reflect on that, monitoring what's going on. That doesn't mean you have to be a news junkie. You don't want to waste a whole lot of time reading all the news or watching all the news, but watching some. Just to be aware of what's happening and reflecting on that from a prophetic standpoint, that's within the spirit of the Sabbath. An occasional documentary on the creation or on Bible history might be beneficial, where you have gotten home and you have a couple of hours, especially in the summertime before the Sabbath ends. You want to add to your understanding of God's Word. We watched one. We got home from running the circuit 2 weeks ago, and Amanda had one on Job. I said, "Oh, this is interesting. What is this? What do these people say about the book of Job?" They were imbeciles. They had no idea about Job. We gleaned two things. One, a little bit of historical information, because they would actually tell you what other experts say. And there were a couple of experts they were citing there that had some sense. The ones who were being interviewed had no sense at all. They had no perspective of Job, whatever. And I realized, you know, I've heard those arguments about Job time and again. Sometimes it's important to hear the arguments of opposition. And then you marshal your thinking of that. That's wrong. Why is that wrong? And you look through the Bible and out there, that's why it's wrong. They're not reading the book. They don't believe God exists. Some of them didn't at all. They were atheists talking about Job. And so not all of them were, but some of them were. And you shake your head how little they understand what a blessing is, what we do understand. But occasionally a documentary on that can be beneficial. But it isn't a time not for doing sports or for watching sports and things like that or other entertainments. With small children, it's a time to bring out Sabbath toys. We did this from time to time. We would have a Sabbath toy when our daughter was small. And she got to play with it at services. It was a quiet toy, you know, that just kept her hands occupied a little bit. But it was special because she didn't have it every day. It was only on the Sabbath, which helped remember that the Sabbath was holy. It's also important to do some meditation. I want to give a whole sermon on Sabbath meditations and meditation generally, but especially Sabbath meditation. So I have made a list. A very long list already of things you could meditate on. That's the problem. When I sit down to meditate, so what am I going to think about? Think about drumming my fingers for a while. There's a certain rhythm to drumming fingers. You can't get two words together into a cohesive thought. What I want to think about right now. So I've started thinking about what we ought to think about. I've made a list and I will have that as a handout when I give the meditation sermon sometime after the feast. Then you'll have a ready-made list. Okay, oh, boy, this will be an interesting. I'm going to think about that. And you sit and think about it. It's circumstances in the Bible, different Bible characters, different Bible events, and what lessons do you learn from that. The things that you could read a passage and then you can think about it. That's really good meditation time. Meditation is, from an educational point of view, as Mr. Coe was talking about education in the sermonette, meditation is sinking in what you've learned, putting it down deep to where you've got instant access to it, to apply things and to analyze things and as you go forward. Now, let's look at another aspect of Sabbath keeping. We'll turn to Matthew this time, chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, Christ came at a time when the Pharisees, who were a leading sort of school of thought among the Jews, they became, by the way, the Pharisees became Judaism. There were two primary groups. They were both religious and political at the time. One was the Sadducees. The Sadducees were the priests. For the most part, they were priests. They were highly educated, mostly, you know, could and therefore could read and write. But they were the aristocracy of the Jews at that time. And King David's descendants weren't ruling the Jews in the days of Christ. Some of his descendants were there, Joseph and Mary, both of them descended from David through different lines. None of the princes of Judah, who were the ruling descendants of David, were in power. That had been moved. That line had been moved to another area, over actually to Ireland and then Scotland and then England by the time of Christ. But at the time, you had the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Sadducees were the priests. They didn't believe much. They didn't believe there was any future afterlife, because all they believed of Scripture was the first five books, the things that Moses wrote, Genesis to Deuteronomy. There's no specific mention of a devil, so they didn't believe there was a devil. Or angels, either. They really didn't believe very much. But they believed in power, and they had it. Now, power and wealth and influence. And so they ruled the Jews under the umbrella of the Romans, of course. They ruled the Jews. They were the dominant force. The Pharisees believed in the entire Old Testament, but they believed in something that had developed during the previous two or three centuries before Christ came, called the oral law. It was the oral traditions of various rabbis in Israel and over in the area of Babylon, because many Jews never came back. They still lived over there at that time. So they thought the oral law was just as inspired as the written law. They were wrong. The written law was inspired. The oral law wasn't. And Christ was constantly, you know, in a verbal and intellectual sword fight with the Pharisees over those issues and with the Sadducees over the other issues. Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. Pharisees at least did believe in a resurrection. Those were the dynamics. Now, the Pharisees were the nitpickers. And they nitpicked about the Sabbath. They made a whole long list of things that you can't do on the Sabbath. You can't swat a fly on the Sabbath. That's work. They're just strange. You can't carry anything heavier than a fig. You know, well, what if you have a really monstrous fig? I don't know. Mess with their minds a little bit. So we'll pick this up. It's an argument that he had with them in Matthew chapter 12. You learn a lot from these arguments. You understand where the Pharisees were coming from and the limits of their understanding, and you see how the truth was applied under duress, and Christ set the record straight. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry. And they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath." Now, is anybody reading the King James? The old King, the regular King James? It says corn, doesn't it? They were plucking ears of corn. You know, I was in college for 2 years before I realized they weren't plucking ears of corn. You know, what we call corn, the British call maize. What we call grain, they call corn. So wheat and barley, oh, that's all corn over there. And that, when I was working on a research farm during my Ambassador College years in the English campus of Ambassador College, I finally realized that that's what they meant. We were driving to a national fair. Bear in mind, England's only the size of one of our states. So, you know, when you have the Royal Agriculture Show, it's a national fair, where there would be a state fair here. So we were going to the national fair. We actually got to see the Queen and Prince Philip. They happened to be there that day. But as we're going down the highway, the two Yorkshire fellows that I worked with, they would say, "Oh, look at that field of corn over there." And I'd look. I thought, where? Maybe it's off in the distance. And he's got good eyesight. Nothing but a wheat field. A barley field. And they called that corn too. And then it finally dawned on me. Oh. So when they were plucking heads of grain, in the King James it said corn. I thought they were breaking off ears of corn like we grew sweet corn and then eating it. And I thought, that'd be an awful mess. Have you ever eaten sweet corn that you didn't cook? It squirts everywhere. It's good, but, and you know, when you're really hungry, you do it. But when you take wheat or barley, you can pluck those heads when they're nearly ripe, but not quite. Pluck them off and you rub them in your hands and you break the husks off that way and you get a fistful of grain, throw it in your mouth and you eat it. Grab another one and do the same thing. And you can actually make a meal out of it as they're walking along. And you think, well, they're stealing somebody's corn. No, God allowed for that. That people walking by could snack on your fields or your orchards. That was all part of the way he set things up. So they were doing that, but the Pharisees said that plucking those heads of corn was too much work on the Sabbath. And so they took exception with that, and Christ responded in verse 3. "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him, and how he entered the house of God and he ate the showbread that was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?" Now, the background of this you'll find in 1 Samuel. But David was running from Saul's executors. He was one of those times when he was being in hot pursuit. And they came up to Shiloh in the northern part of Israel, where the tabernacle was set up at the time. And they were running on empty. They were literally running away from Saul's executors, who were hot on their trail and outnumbered them. And David and his men had no weapons. So they had to run and had to stay out of weapons reach. They came to the tabernacle. He asked the high priest, "Do you have anything you can feed us?" And he said, "All I have is the showbread." The showbread were bread loaves that were baked specifically to be for show in the tabernacle, later the temple, on golden tables. They would be set there. Now, eventually, then the priest would eat the bread. The priests were allowed to eat that bread. And not David. David wasn't a priest. Neither were his men. But he said, "All I have is the showbread." And so he said, "I'll get that for you," because this was an extreme duress. So they were able to eat that. And then he also armed David. He gave him Goliath's sword. Yeah, for some reason it had been stored there after David had killed Goliath. The sword had been stored with the high priest at the tabernacle. But that's the occasion that we're talking about here. Or in verse 5, "Have you not read in the law on the Sabbath that the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath?" This is verse 5. "And are blameless." What do you mean profane? Well, on the Sabbath, there were added sacrifices, animal sacrifices of sheep and oxen that had to be slaughtered and offered as sacrifices, either as a burnt offering or as a thank offering, various ones that had to be done. I mean, either any case, it meant the slaughtering of a full-sized animal. They worked doing the work a butcher does. And if you've ever been to a slaughterhouse and watched a butcher at work, there's a lot of work in dispatching an animal, skinning the animal, cutting off the meat, hanging the quarters, even if you don't cut all the meat into packages, hanging the quarters. It's heavy-duty work. And the priest did that routinely on the Sabbath. Now, the important point to understand in this case, especially by the time Christ is giving this instruction, because some people say, "Well, I have to profane the Sabbath by doing all the work after church and setting everything up and running it all instead of letting others help out with that." The priests only served 2 weeks out of the year, because David divided them into 24 subdivisions, and each division would be on duty from Sabbath noon to Sabbath noon, 1 week, and then they would go home. They served as the educators and the social services, I think, of the country back in where they lived. And the next division had come in, and they had a changing of the guard at noon, and the other division then would take over. And the only other time they actually had to be doing the work of the priesthood by the time of Christ was during the annual holy days. The Passover week, they were all on duty. The week that surrounded Pentecost, they were all on duty. The week of Feast of Tabernacles, they were all on duty then. They were all in Jerusalem, all working, because there were lots and lots on holy days, lots of extra sacrifices that had to be made, and it was pretty much nonstop activity, so you needed them all there to share the load and make the load relatively light for one person, as far as that goes. So this was the profaning of the Sabbath, meant that they did some labor, heavy labor on the Sabbath, but it was that which God commanded that had to be done. "Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Now Christ just explained something to them that they didn't quite catch at that time. Later they did. He explained that he was personally the master of the Sabbath, and what was Sabbath keeping and what was Sabbath breaking. Not somebody who tries to speak for Christ without his spirit and his wisdom, but one that Christ himself was able to teach that. So it is okay to eat. We can draw some things at this from this. It's okay to eat on the Sabbath, and some food preparation. I mean, even if breaking the grain with your hands and that sort of thing. There is some travel that's certainly permitted on the Sabbath. So they were walking through the grain field because they were going to where Christ was getting ready to preach and teach. Was another aspect to that as well. So there is some effort expended on the Sabbath that is still within the spirit and keeping of the Sabbath. Let's go now to Luke 13 for two other examples in understanding principles of how to keep the Sabbath holy. When we talk about profaning the Sabbath, you know, the ministry today has throughout our many decades of history. The Sabbath is usually our longest day. Certainly is here in a church circuit where you're traveling at some distance. In our early training years in the ministry, we lived in Missoula, Montana, and the other end of the circuit was Great Falls. That was 170 miles. We don't have 170 miles to get from here to back home. But 170 miles over the Continental Divide. That was a beautiful drive, there's no doubt about it, but it was a long day. And we would get up early, leave town at 6, arrive in Great Falls at about 9:30, just in time for services. They all had to be down there by 9:30. One of the men who set up the chairs drove 120 miles to be there, but he just was an early bird, so he was there. And there weren't too many chairs to set up for a church of 55 in those days. We would have services. We would visit and counsel for a half hour, maximum 45 minutes, and get back in the car and eat lunch on the road while we're driving, get over there as fast as we could for a 3:30 service in Missoula. So it was a long day. And then afterwards, we'd stand and talk for a long time afterwards over there. It was longer in the wintertime, though, as you had whiteouts, when you had blizzards blowing and you come up over the pass, especially you get the snow blowing, and suddenly everything goes white. So what we did is we memorized the highway. Okay, we're going into a right-hand bend, not a sharp one, but a little bit sharp. So let's keep a steady hand on the wheel, and then suddenly the wind would blow again and everything would clear, and you could see where you were headed for the snowbank, and you make a hard left and avoid that. But even if you hit a snowbank, you just hit a snowbank. Instead of hitting rocks or going off the cliff. Now, that was the problem when we went over the pass. You didn't want to go off to one side because it was a couple 300 feet straight down. So you avoided whiteouts going up the pass. You came up there a little slower. Luke 13, verse 10 to 16. Now, he was teaching, verse 10 of Luke 13, he was teaching one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years, and she was bent over and could not raise herself up. Now, you've probably seen folks with bad backs for one reason or another that literally are bent over. They're okay if they're sitting in a chair because they're in the normal position. But when they get up, they're still sitting in the chair as far as the way the back just won't straighten. 18 years. And Jesus saw her, he called her and said to her, "Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. So he healed a long time health condition. He healed her right there. The ruler of the synagogue, which would have been a Pharisee, the Pharisees' power was the synagogues. The Sadducees ruled at the temple, but the Pharisees ruled out in the districts because they were the ones who were the masters of the synagogues. That's where they got their power base politically among the Jews. The ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, and he said to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day." And the Lord answered him and said, "Hypocrite, do not each of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water? So ought this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath." And when he said these things, all his adversaries were put to shame, and the multitude rejoiced all the glorious things that were done by him. Now, the principle is, he talked about the ox and the donkey being fed. Today, we have very few involved in agriculture, so it's an issue that hardly ever comes up in the church, but a few decades ago there we had a lot of men involved in agriculture. So you had to analyze, how much work should I be set up to do on the Sabbath? You have to feed the animals. We had a small feedlot of never more than about 400 animals in that, or beef in that. But what we did is we planned ahead, so we did as much prep work on Friday as possible, loading the truck with the silage and the ground hay so that we would only have to load it once on the Sabbath morning, which didn't take very long with the tractor. We minimized it. Sometimes we would throw bales down where we had to feed hay to our stock cows. In the wintertime, we'd throw the bales down along the feeder so that what we had to do on the Sabbath is come and cut the strings or yank the wires off. We had a wire baler. You couldn't cut those. And then we'd kick the flakes of hay up into the feeder where they could get to them. So we did as much as we could, but there was still some work that had to be done. The cows had to be milked. That didn't take long, and horses had to be, some hay had to be carried to them. So you minimize what you do, but the principle was you look after your livestock. They need to be cared for, just the basic care. You're not out there working them in the field, you're just the basic care that they need. So there are certain Sabbath duties that have to be done from time to time. And then there are the emergencies that come up in chapter 14, verse 1 to 5. Now it happened, he went into the house of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat on the Sabbath, and they watched him closely, and behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. So he's over at the Pharisees' place on the Sabbath, and they're careful to be only serving half figs at a time. And Jesus answering spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" He was really pushing this issue with them. And they kept silent. And he took the man who had dropsy, and he healed him and let him go. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit," in the King James it says into a ditch, "will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day?" And they could not answer him regarding these things. And they would. You've got livestock that's struggling in a ditch. I remember one cow, it was a cow we had to pull out of a ditch, sort of a one-sided ditch. And I remember it was a Sabbath day when this happened. This cow had laid down to have her calf on a slope, but there was the trail that went down to where the water tank was went right along there. And they had, from usage, they cut the bank had been cut like this, that far. She laid right down, she wasn't very bright. She laid down right down near the edge of that, and as she was straining to give birth, she rolled and landed straight on her back in the mud, and it was just enough of a depression on the other side, she couldn't get herself righted up. A cow will die when it's on its back for very long. So I came around the corner and saw that and immediately ran to get my dad. We pulled the tractor over there, and we put a log chain around her neck and pulled her out of the ditch. But she didn't have horns. We'd have used the horns. So we had to pull her by the neck. We got her up onto the slope where it was flatter, and she was still trying to have this calf. We pulled the calf. It was dead. So we just wanted to try to save her. She was suffering from hypothermia because it was a pretty cold night. She'd probably been there most of the night. So we grabbed some old bales of hay from the previous year that were good and dry, and we put a big ring around her, out about 10 feet from her, and torched him. So she was in a burning ring of fire. She got warm, and it kind of made her crazy. Animals don't like fire that much, but there wasn't any other choice. And she kind of bugged out her eyes after that. And she was kind of mean, too. We called her the bug-o-eyed mean cow, or the bug-eyed mean cow. And for some unexplainable reason, we decided we needed to keep her in the same corral as the milk cows. Now, she survived. She got well the next year. And for years, she raised strong, healthy calves. But we were a little concerned about her mental condition, so we kept her where we could keep an eye on her. She would get upset if the dog came anywhere near the corral when she had a calf. And she'd chase us all out. So you're milking. We trained our cows just stand still wherever we were. We didn't put them in barns, they'd get soft. And we'd sit down and we'd milk 3 gallons of milk and go. But we're milking while we're keeping our eye on where this bug-eyed mean cow is, because if she takes a notion to chase after us, we got to grab the bucket and vault the fence. It was exciting living on the farm. It was always a rodeo. All right. Now, this gives us some principles. There are certain things that need to be done on the Sabbath for, the health and welfare of humans and livestock. But otherwise, we don't go to doing extra work beyond that. Now let's talk about at church, during the church service. How do we keep the Sabbath holy? There are a couple of principles. One is to be drawn from two dead sons of Aaron. Leviticus 10. Aaron was the high priest. He was the brother of Moses. The priesthood of the tribe of Levi, which was the priesthood for all of Israel, would descend from Aaron, not from Moses. That was God's call. So when God made that decision, and he instructed, therefore, Moses to set Aaron and his sons, and he had about at least four sons, grown sons by that time, that they would then be the priests. And there was a ceremony they went through. They were consecrated to be the priests, and now they were just beginning their service in the priesthood and in serving at the tabernacle was just completed. He had the altar of burnt offerings outside the tabernacle, which was the tabernacle itself was a portable temple. Then inside the tabernacle and later the temple was the altar of incense. And it was like a wood stove of sorts, and probably therefore the primary heat source for inside the building. Because the priests would go in with their censers. A censer was a long ladle, a very ornate one, very beautifully decorated, undoubtedly with gold and silver and jewels and things. The things that reflected the quality and the beauty of the temple. And they would scoop out of the inside of that, the fire inside the altar of incense, a coal, a hot coal. And then they would take a handful of the incense, which was in powdered form. It was a recipe that one family of the Levites, and sometime we'll do a Bible study on the Levites' duties, but one of the families specifically had the duty of preparing that. And they developed the recipe. It involved frankincense and myrrh and other beautiful spices. And then they would sprinkle that down on that coal in the censer as they went about certain ceremonies inside the tabernacle. And that was one of the things that they did. So Nadab and Abihu were two of the older two sons of Aaron. One of them, whichever was the oldest, probably Nadab, would have been the next high priest, had it not been for his and his brother's wrong approach. The next high priest was Eleazar. He was the number three son of Aaron. The number one and two died. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer, and put fire in it, and put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord. It doesn't specify what the profane fire was. Did they have incense that God didn't want to be used there? That could be. He was very adamant that it would be a certain thing. And when God's adamant, he's adamant. And he makes the final call. And they had disobeyed God. Oh, no, this is good enough. No, we want to do it this way. Now, we don't want to do what God says. We want to do it our way. Something like that was going on because there was an attitude issue here. They offered the profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. They did not respect God's presence in the temple or the tabernacle at this time. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. When their cousins, Moses called up their cousins to pick them up by their tunics and haul them out of the camp and bury them, why did they just pick them up by the tunics? Well, I suspect they were fairly well incinerated inside the tunics. Is why. I mean, it just seems reasonable. Otherwise, he would, grab them by the shoulders and the heels and carry them out. But no, they picked them up by the tunics, by their uniform that they were wearing. They did not respect God's holiness. Now, the Sabbath is holy. God's presence was in the tabernacle. His presence is in the Sabbath. There's a lesson for us. We need to respect what God has made holy when we're at church services. Now, notice what God then said in the latter part of verse 3. Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified. We don't play fast and loose with concepts about God or with our attitudes about God. Those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. If that would be the ministry today, or those who, you know, serve in ministerial functions at times. In that time, it was the priests, those who come near me, because they're the ones who came actually into the tabernacle. And before all the people, I must be glorified. This goes even beyond what we call respect. It's deeper than that, to glorify God and to regard him as holy. So Moses said, this is what God said. Now, obviously, Nadab and Abihu didn't do it. So Aaron held his peace. Normally, at a time like that, with the death of two of your sons, grown sons, there would be great wailings and mournings. Aaron was not allowed to mourn. Neither were his other sons. He said, your nephews, your brother's sons will take care of this. You stand your ground and do your duty. And that had to be hard. You know, you told him in verse 6, Moses said to Aaron and to Eleazar and Ithamar, the other two sons, do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes. That was a sign of mourning and great grief. Lest you die. You're on duty. You don't do those things when you're on duty before God. And wrath come upon all the people. But let your brethren and the whole house of Israel bewail the burning which the Lord has kindled. You shall not go to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. And they did according to the word of Moses. But Nadab and Abihu didn't do according to the word of Moses or the word of God. Now, you wonder, well, what did they do? What was it? What was the issue here? We might glean at least part of it from the next paragraph, beginning in verse 8, goes to verse 11. Then the Eternal spoke to Aaron, saying, do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. Huh. Just as we supposed, too much alcohol may well have been involved with Nadab and Abihu. The good old boy attitude. You know, we're going to get drunk and goof off and be crazy. Boom, you're dead, just like that. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations that you may distinguish between the holy and the unholy, between the unclean and the clean. And that you may, then this is the duty of the priest, it's the duty of the ministry now, duty of us all and helping each other, that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes that the Lord has spoken by the hand of Moses. So no drunkenness. When drunkenness, you think, yeah, well, what about using marijuana? You understand why they say that? Because they're dopey, literally. It makes them stupid. The reason the use of hallucinogenic drugs is forbidden by God is because it's instant drunkenness. Drunkenness is the sin that will keep you out of the kingdom of God, one of the sins listed in Revelation. And the use of the drugs is instant drunkenness. That's why it's wrong. With alcohol, it isn't instant because some alcohol can be consumed, and God actually provides and even commands it with the Passover, but when he goes to a certain beyond that limit, which appears may have played very significantly into Nadab and Abihu's case, then it's drunkenness, and that's a sin. You lose control of your faculties, and you say things and do things that you should not say or do. Whatever the case, we have here a great lesson. Now, and there's another lesson. They didn't respect their uniforms. There were specific uniforms. They dressed up for the Sabbath and for service before God, and the priesthood did. You can read in Exodus 39, and I'll let you do that on your own time, maybe this afternoon, think about the principle there, the garments of the priesthood. And they were very meticulous. And then if you want to add on to that, go to the latter chapters of Ezekiel. I don't really have the chapter in my mind where it describes what the priests during the millennium, there will be a tabernacle, a new temple in Jerusalem, and it will be in operation, and there will be a priesthood, and the sacrifices will be reinstituted then. There is a hiatus from them, from the sacrifice of Christ until the second coming of Christ, but they'll be reinstituted then, and it describes the uniforms the priests will wear then, which are very similar to the ones that Aaron and his sons had to wear. Now, that meant they dressed up. They didn't dress down when they came before God. We come before God on the Sabbath, so we want to dress up, not dress down. Now, the fashion of today is to dress casual and even sloppily. Come as you are, is what you hear the churches say. Yeah, that's not what God says. You come before me with respect and with honor. This is a great lesson here. Put down 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11. All these things happen to them to be examples for us. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. You can read that one later. But we can, I'll read it right now. Why not? We got to go to 1 Corinthians 14 anyway. So we can stop in chapter 10 for a brief moment in time. Chapter 10 recites the events of the Exodus and some of the wandering. And then when you get down to verse 11, you know, when it gets in past the Exodus, it tells all the misbehavior of the Israelites. Now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they're written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. We learn from Nadab and Abihu. And we learn from anything in the Old Testament. And we learn actually in the same principle from that in the New Testament as well. Now over to chapter 14. In chapter 14, we have the issue of speaking in tongues. Speaking in tongues then is nothing to do with Pentecostalism of today. Pentecostalism isn't speaking in a particular language. It's demonically induced gobbledygook. What we have here that Paul was talking about is people who could actually speak in other languages. Corinth was a port city. A port city would have many nationalities, therefore many language cultures represented. So if somebody who normally communicated in, say, the Scythian language, and was one of the leading men in the congregation, had a message that he was to give, he could give it if there was somebody there who could translate it into Greek so that those who were speaking Greek could understand it. And if there was another group that didn't speak Greek or not enough Greek, then needed a translator for that so that you didn't have people getting up and giving these great messages in a language nobody else understood, which makes no sense. But they, you know, people who know things others don't can sometimes be a point of vanity. And so they were having problems in the Corinthian church. We'll begin in verse 26 and go to the end. Now, how is it then, brethren, Paul says, whenever you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. Now, this was addressing the local ministry and leading men in particular here. If anyone speaks in a tongue, and the word in Greek is glossa, which is the same word used for language, speaks in a language, let there be two, or at the most three, each in turn. The church service is to be orderly. You may have two or three speakers, but they will take turns. They won't be standing up here speaking at the same time, trying to get your attention and get you to ignore what so-and-so is saying. That would be lunacy. But they had some lunatics running loose in Corinth, and Paul was having to straighten some things out. But if there is no interpreter, let him keep silent in the church. Let him speak to himself and to God. You know, he can pray in the Scythian language or whatever other language he happens to know, even though there aren't other brethren that know that language. But make sure you have an interpreter when you have somebody speaking in a language the others need to understand. We follow that principle. In some of our feast sites, we have interpreters that will interpret the message. If you go down to one of the feast sites in Central or South America, there'll be an interpreter that will interpret into English. If it's where the Sigleys are, it'll be Mrs. Sigley is doing the interpreting. And you'll hear her in the headphones as she interprets what her husband is saying in Spanish to the bulk of the brethren. Let two or three prophets speak, and the others judge. You know, sit by and think and listen and consider. That's the concept here. But if anything is revealed to another who sits by, let the first be silent. Take your turns. You can all prophesy one by one, and all learn that all may be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. That's an important statement there in verse 32. You know, in a Pentecostal movement, the spirits or the mental faculties of the individual are not subject to the individual. You know, they're giving themselves over to a different power, and it's not an angelic power. It's the opposite of the holy angels. It's demonic power. The spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. They are in control of their faculties. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. The church is to have a peaceful spirit about it, an orderly spirit about it. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it's shameful for them to speak in church. Now, we have Bible classes. You know, we don't have, you know, during the church service, exchanges back and forth. But in Bible classes, we do. A Bible class is it's not the official church service, and it's a time for, you know, the workshop of learning. So where you have a question, then we can field the question. Not a problem. So we do it to a certain degree in Bible studies, but we typically do that with written questions. Sometimes we, you know, can take it over to more of a Bible class as well, but not the church service. Or was it you only that did the Word of God originally come to you, or was it you only that it reached? So you have a lot of arrogance there. You have people who think that they're the be-all and the end-all. If anybody thinks of himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge the things that I write to you are the commandments of the Lord. But if anyone is ignorant, let him be ignorant. In other words, take note of that. Therefore, brethren, desire earnestly to prophesy. Do not forbid to speak in tongues or other languages. Let all things be done decently and in order. That is the picture of how our church service should be. Decently and in order, with a peaceful spirit, respectfulness, modesty in conduct as well as in dress. So let's talk about dress for a minute. There is one brief parable I need you to read in Matthew 22, and then we'll get into the final point in these last few minutes of the message. Matthew 22. And it's the first 14 verses. A parable of Christ. The kingdom of heaven, or kingdom of God. Matthew called it the kingdom of heaven. Sometimes he called it the kingdom of God. Kingdom of heaven in the sense that that's where God is. Is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son. So here's the parable. And he sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, but they were not willing to come. He invited all these people to come to the wedding of his son. A great, you know, landowner, you know, happy to, wanting to share the joy his family was experiencing, and they didn't want to come. So he sent out other servants saying, well, tell those who are invited, see, I prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed. I mean, only got so much time before the meat spoils. So, you know, come and enjoy the meal. All things are ready. Come to the wedding. So they went out, these other servants did, but the response was that the people made light of it and went their ways, each to his own farm, another to his business, and the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. Well, I asked you to come to a wedding, and you killed my servant? That was the wrong thing to do. It was the wrong thing to do, but when the king heard about it, he was furious. And he sent out his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, the wedding is ready, but those who are invited were not worthy. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding. So they went out to the highways, to the pathways between the cities. And they invited everybody they could find, gathered them up, both the bad and the good, and the wedding was filled with guests. And when the king came to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. You were just invited to a wedding. You're supposed to wear a wedding garment to a wedding. That's how you dress for a wedding. And so he came up to him and he said, friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment? And he was speechless. And the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot and take him out and cast him into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. All right, so that's kind of an ominous story. You know, Christ told these parables. They were always stories, and people were entranced by the story. And, oh, You know, how dare they not come when he invited them to the wedding, and then they killed his servants. They got what they deserved. And then he went out and pulled everybody in that they could find, and then somebody, one of them came, and he wasn't dressed for a wedding. He didn't show respect to the bride and the groom and the father of the groom at all by just showing up, you know, come as you are approach. And so that's what happened to him. Well, there's some lessons here. We have a duty and calling much higher than just pleasing ourselves. We live in an age that is all about pleasing itself. It dresses to please itself. It doesn't really care about others. We're called out of that. We do care about others, and we particularly care about God above all things. You know, I've heard the argument, because we're affected by the fashions and the moods and the attitudes of society, I've heard the argument, well, this is my church. I want to be comfortable when I come to church. So I'm just dressing down, you know, be really super casual. News for that person. It's not their church. Whose church is this? It's God's. This is God's day. This is God's church. And we've been invited. And so we need to come in the right attitude, the right conversation, even the right dress and decorum that shows respect for it. God's way, as I said, is not come as you are. This is holy time, and we're here to keep this day holy as God has given it to us for that great blessing. So thinking about then, our conduct needs to be reverent, cheerful, even truly joyful, because God's way is wonderful. It is to be a time of respect, of an attitude of respectfulness as well, because we are respectful to God above all things, but respectful of each other. We take time to listen to those who you maybe struggle getting their idea out or their point across. It's a time of peacefulness, and we need to pray that God, just give me a spirit of peace, and I'll leave all the other stuff that I've been dealing with all week behind me so I can come and share good fellowship, another quality of the Sabbath and keeping it holy, good fellowship with the brethren, pure language, making sure that we root out any references to the curse words, even the euphemisms, the dangs and the darns and all the older sort of watered-down cuss words. We forget about those. Those are called euphemisms. They carry the same meaning as the actual word itself. So we want to root those out. Now, that for long-term habits, that takes a while, but work at it hard. Again, the dress-wise, as far as the decorum, the wedding garment, or the Sabbath garment in our case, we dress up. The men typically with a tie, if it's a hot day, you don't necessarily need a jacket, but a jacket and a tie, or a suit and a tie, dress slacks and such. That's appropriate for men. I talked about this once years ago, and there was a young fellow in university, and so he hadn't been dressing up, and I mentioned that to him and heard the sermon. So the next Sabbath, he was dressed up in a sky blue tuxedo with a frilly shirt. He had trouble with balance. I had lost track of him. That was a long time ago. He was only in our area for a little over a year. I hope he regained balance, because he didn't have a right. That's not what we're talking about. And that might be worn as a wedding garment, and it'd be the only time it's worn. You know, a sky blue tuxedo and a frilly shirt. We dress, so basically it's American business formal is the standard. And we look to that because it shows respectfulness to God, and it's nice to be dressed up. My father used to complain about the ties. And he was strong, big through the shoulders, and then fairly large neck to go with it. Well, I don't think he ever dawned on him, you know, that if you got a 16.5-inch neck shirt, you wouldn't feel like you were choking when you put the tie on. And the other thing is, you don't have to have it that tight. You can loosen it up to where you can actually breathe. But, you know, he wore a tie, and he did learn that the double Windsor was not his. He knew all kinds of knots, but I knew double Windsors, and he didn't know that. He used a single Windsor for his tie and his tie. But it was a big step for Dad. He never dressed up for anything except funerals and weddings until God called him into the church. And then it changed. Now, he wore his boots, but they were dress boots for the occasion. For women, recapture the true values of modesty. And believe me, all you have to do is peruse a few of the fashion pages, and you just think, oh, man, what planet did these people come from? I mean, it's like they turn their heads sideways and bang on the other side of it and drain out any sense they ever had. But where did they? Who was there to teach them sense and decorum? You know, we've been without it as a culture for several generations now, largely without it. So I guess we can't expect much more from them, but we can expect more from ourselves. Dress, a dress or skirt or dress slacks, dress slack suit, that's certainly appropriate on the Sabbath as well. Obviously feminine. That's important, that it's obviously feminine. And beware of the world's fashion slide, because they are sliding. When it comes to tops, modest. Now, this is not where cleavage belongs at church. And avoid the strapless or the spaghetti strap type jackets. Too much flesh is distracting, even when it's relatively modest otherwise. And, you know, even if you have a jacket, little jacket or a scarf that goes over the shoulders, then that's not a problem. Hem length is important. They're starting to get short, although the newest fashions, conservative fashions, we saw a catalog, and wow, the dresses and skirts look very, very appropriate, very modest in that sense from the one we saw just this past week that happened to come in the mail. Bear in mind that hems hike up when you sit down, so you have to give thought to that. But otherwise, you know, digest these basic principles and dress accordingly, act accordingly, because this is all a part of keeping the Sabbath holy. And we have been called, part of the very few who have been, to know what the Sabbath is and to understand God's Word. What a privilege it is to be where we are. Sabbath holiness translates into a right and teachable attitude. It affects our conversation, our dress, all aspects of our behavior, all aspects of our